Welcome to another episode of the Mapscaping Podcast. My name is Daniel and this is a podcast for the geospatial community. My guest on the show today is Brian Timoney. Last year on post-GIS Day, you know, the day after GIS Day, Brian gave a talk called Refactoring the Way We Talk About SQL. It is costing us money, which is a great title. But now if you imagine we just remove the SQL bit and insert your geospatial skills, now we have a title that reads Refactoring the Way You Talk About Your Geospatial Skills. It is costing you money. And that is what my conversation with Brian is all about. It's about understanding the difference between what you are selling and what people are willing to pay for. It's about the importance of aligning your skill set with what the market sees as valuable. And sometimes the only difference is the way we talk about things. But more on that later. First, I want to thank this week's sponsors, Scribble Maps and Mergent Maps. But let's start with Scribble Maps. You can use Scribble Maps to augment your current GIS workflows and bring GIS to all levels of your organization. So just a couple of things to focus on here. Firstly, augment, not replace. Scribble Maps and ArcGIS Pro, QGIS, or dare I say even GRASS would be a really powerful combination. Scribble Maps is not a replacement for any of these tools, but it would be a fantastic augmentation. Secondly, bring GIS to all levels of your organization. This is easier said than done. You need the right combination of functionality and ease of use. I'm currently struggling with this exact challenge in my current consulting role, and a tool like Scribble Maps would be a far better fit for this than the current software that I am forced to use. If you're interested in checking out Scribble Maps, book a one-to-one demo with Scribble Maps today and mention Mapscaping for a discount. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Our second sponsor is Mergent Maps. Mergent Maps is a QGIS field survey app for seamless geo data collaboration and easy synchronization. You can use it to capture data in the field, on and offline. It has customizable forms. You can attach photos and export to various formats. And it plays nicely with external GPS devices. The app is available for Android and Apple devices. So if you're interested, you could just download Mergent Maps and try it out. I'll put a link to that in the show notes of this episode. So thank you very much to Scribble Maps and Mergent Maps for supporting this podcast episode. By supporting this episode, they're actually supporting all of the episodes. So I really appreciate their support. Thank you. Okay, on to the interview. Hey, Brian, welcome to the podcast. I'm really looking forward to this, partly because you're an extremely entertaining person to talk with. You have a lot of what I think are very, very interesting ideas. And partly because it's a conversation that I hope is going to revolve around better pay, making more money, and how we do that. And maybe it's even not through learning new skills. Maybe it's just through better marketing of the skills that we have today. But this will come out in the wash. Normally, before I push the record button, I ask the guests, how should I refer to you? What's your title? And your response to this question was data contractor, geospatial. It's pretty vague. I think, you know, hashtag it's complicated. I think we could have put that on there. And this is going to be part of the conversation later on. But before I ramble on too long here, maybe a brief introduction is in order. Could you just give us an idea? Who are you? How did you get involved in geospatial? Why should we listen to you?
Well, Daniel, thank you for inviting me onto the podcast. As we say in sports talk radio in the United States, longtime listener, first time caller. So yeah, I have been a consultant, contractor, data janitor, as some people refer to it online, in only semi-ironic tones. And I've been bumping around the geospatial world for about 20 years now. And like so many people who get into geospatial, the love of geography came at a very early age, whether it's the Rand McNally Road Atlas that constituted the only reading material in the backseat of the family car, or I remember very specifically the day my father brought home USGS topographic maps of upstate Pennsylvania, and I was blown away. My eight-year-old mind was blown away by this whole different visual grammar than what we found in the road atlas. And then, you know, you get older, and I am a proud member of that non-elite fraternity of liberal arts majors from university. So, of course, you're always searching for that profession that is both vocation and avocation. And in my case, I ended up finding GIS in Albuquerque, New Mexico, And I landed on something that hit both the left side of the brain and right side of the brain, like so many of us are attracted to the profession. And I need to mention that that introduction to GIS class in Albuquerque, 1995-ish, my classmate was Kurt Menke, who has also been a guest on this podcast. So the lesson for the listeners is the geospatial world is very, very small. So be careful of what bridges professionally you want to burn, because everyone is one degree of separation. And so professionally, and it's going to be one of the through lines of the conversation today, I've dabbled either through consulting, contracting, working for a couple of startups, you know, the big areas of geospatial use, whether it's utilities, whether it's defense, whether it's local government, whether it's federal. So I feel like if the trajectory of my career has seemed haphazard to me at times, you know, looking back on it now, there's enough of a through line of the variety of experiences and the different relationships I've had for job titles and compensation. I think that's as good a qualification as any for what we're about to discuss on today's episode.
I totally agree. I appreciate that introduction. Well done. Just as a quick test here, do you remember Slippy Maps? And if you do, what do they mean to you?
Yes, right. For the listeners, I'm of a certain age that I remember the pre-Slippy Map era very distinctly of single web call, wait an eternity for an image to be generated, and a single image shows up in your browser. And I was so fired up by Slippy Maps and the first iteration of Google Maps that I was working with a developer friend of mine to inject my own data into Google Maps before they had an API. That's how excited I was about the web mapping revolution. And the launch of Google Earth was around that same time frame. And Dan, you have no idea between the mapping technology and where I was at in my career, there was no way I wasn't going to become rich off this mapping revolution.
Yeah. Yeah. It was all up and to the right, wasn't it? Amazing time. Okay. Back to reality here. A little bit more about your current sort of status, position in the market, if you will. Are you self-employed currently, or are you working as an employee for someone?
Yeah, so I've been working the past few years as W-2 contractor, like so many of us in geospatial, and actually with a mix of geospatial positions as well as non-geospatial positions. And, you know, one of the ironies, which of course directly pertains to the topic at hand, is my current position has very little geospatial at all, you know, a subset of my skills, and yet the rewards of the marketplace exceed, you know, the vast majority of my positions that really tested the limits of my geospatial skills. So, you know, you're kind of walking that tightrope of the non-spatial data world. That demand curve looks a lot different than what it looks like within what we would refer to as the traditional GIS sector.
Perfect. This is a perfect segue. Really appreciate that. As a podcast host, this is amazing. So let's talk about this a little bit. Why do you think that is? Why are you making more money using your non-GIS, non-spatial skills than what you might make if that was, you know, in your title, if that was a big part of your role? And I guess what I'm trying to understand here is, it seems ironic because normally we hear the message niche down, you know, be something for someone, not sort of everything to everyone. And non-geospatial, very quickly, we head into the world of IT, but maybe you have some different thoughts on that. Why do you think it is that you make more money, you're just using a fraction of your spatial skills than what you would using your spatial skills?
Yeah, so the phrase, the more kind of direct phrase of niches get riches. And yet here in the geospatial niche, that doesn't seem to have been the case. And so I've actually probably given this a lot more thought than is psychologically healthy. And I will say that it probably goes back to the early days of GIS. And my working theory is because the GIS sector has always explicitly set itself apart from the rest of IT in kind of a parallel situation where we ran our own web servers, we ran our own database servers, we were very self-sufficient. And, you know, the idea of, you know, where do you find GIS people? Oh, down the hall and to the right, the room where the plotter is, right? And so we were never integrated into, quote, mainstream IT. And frankly, a lot of us in geospatial liked it that way. And so, but, you know, the idea is as time went on, you started seeing very specific disparities in compensation as IT became more prominent and people, organizations understood the investment in IT. And then you had this kind of section or department off to the side that made the maps, right?
Yeah,
And literally the joke about the plotter is very intentional because we were so heavily associated with the map output, right? So we were the magicians who knew how to make maps and we liked being the priest of the plotter, right?
Yeah.
No one needed to know how we did things, least of all DBAs or, you know, IT people. So that sort of separation over time has now worked to our disadvantage. And as I brought up this discussion online, it's been fascinating / depressing, shall we say, that a couple of people have chimed in. Like they're looking at, you know, US government consultant compensation rates for job titles, and GIS related job titles structurally are being compensated, you know, 30% less than the equivalent technical skills in a more generic systems analyst type thing.
Wow.
Another colleague sent me the actual numbers that are posted by the city of Albuquerque, right? So, you know, the starting GIS position, you know, might be $23 and the starting systems administrator or system analyst position is $32, right? And, you know, you're like, we're behind 30% just at the beginning of the career. And as more and more people have chimed in on this topic, and we could talk a little bit more about it later in the conversation on LinkedIn, those disparities that we see in the salary tables at the beginning of the career, that diversion just becomes more pronounced as you get into mid and senior career levels.
So I've heard some people refer to this as the spatial discount and, like, you know, kind of, you know, a bit of tongue in cheek, but, you know, there's a real reason why they say that. So, and if I'm understanding you correctly, what you see happening is that back in the good old days, you know, when we were still calling things slippy maps, it was an advantage to be known as the map magician. People left you alone and you did the map magic and put, you know, created these amazing outputs. And then through time, this has become less advantageous for us in the geospatial world because people aren't paying as much money for map magicians as what they're paying for, I don't know, business analysts, just as an example. Am I roughly on the right track here?
Right. And I would kind of frame it in terms kind of GIS people grew up with, you know, from the outset of their career. And the idea of what do we talk about when we talk about map making? 80% of the time and effort going into making a map is getting the data into shape, finding the data, cleaning the data, getting it into some sort of shape. And then the stuff we love, the cartography and final presentation, and oh yes, the North Arrow, that is the final 15 to 20%, right? And so GIS people have always had this implied responsibility of all this data prep and cleaning that was just part of the job. And then in the IT realm, what we're seeing over time is anything data related in general IT, the value of that has just gone up dramatically because people understand the value of the power to manipulate clean, shape data, et cetera, et cetera. So these skills that were a means to an end for any GIS person who wanted to create a map, those data skills standalone, the value of them now exceeds in the marketplace the totality of the basket of GIS skills. And that's why it's such a strange dynamic to talk about, because again, it gets back to this idea that that data manipulation, data understanding, data metadata, data quality, data precision, all those issues that we get inculcated from the beginning of our GIS education, all of those issues now have great value in the more generic IT marketplace because of the increasing recognition of the importance of those specific data-related issues.
So it sounds to me like we don't need to rush out and learn a bunch of new skills. We have those skills. We've been doing them since day one, because that is part of the process of making a map, of doing analysis. I mean, you cannot get around that. So maybe the problem here isn't that we need to go and learn new skills. Maybe the problem here, or the solution here, I should say, is the way we talk about the skills that we have. Perhaps this is a marketing issue.
Well, another piece of the dynamic is the idea is, are we acquiring skills to burnish our data manipulation abilities and having that flexibility, or are we acquiring a vendor-driven set of skills? And whether it be, I mean, it's always, and again, the issue of, do universities teach too much Esri-centric software button pushing? And it's like, that debate has been going on for 25 years, literally. And the idea is, you can see both ways, right? You want your graduates to get jobs. A lot of jobs need Esri-specific software skills, ArcMap, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, as learning spatial analysis and spatial data manipulation using SQL, that is a tool set that could have value way beyond the, you know, immediate set of GIS operations, you know, that are associated with the GIS analyst one. So the idea of, and I refer to it as the GIS silo, so to speak, where we're acquiring skills that only are relevant within a very narrow definition of what we think GIS is, right? And again, this opens the door to the wider conversation of what is modern geospatial versus traditional GIS, et cetera. But the idea of the practitioner needs to take it upon themselves to understand, is my skill acquisition relevant outside this immediate, rather narrow niche called traditionally GIS or geospatial?
Okay, so, and those are really fair comments. I appreciate you saying that. So what you're saying is that acquire different skills. Where can your skills be relevant? If you're in the Esri world, for example, and you know nothing against Esri, but let's pretend for a second that you were in university, or you know, relatively early in your career, and your focus was solely on learning how to manipulate things within Esri software. You might be better served learning, you know, spatial SQL, for example, and getting away from your tie-in to that particular software. So that's one side of it, and I totally accept that argument, by the way. What I would struggle with, though, is the idea that that was enough, that just having those skills was enough. In my mind, at least, and from some of your rants, let me say, in the kindest possible way, I don't think you agree with that either. I don't think you think that's enough either. I think the way we talk about things is really important, that marketing aspect. And I want to refer to some of your ideas around this. So for example, you talked about shaping data. You talked about manipulating data. So this is oftentimes, you know, referred to as data scientists. There's that well-used phrase out there in the world that 80% of data scientists' work is shaping, manipulating, cleaning data. And these are all skills that we have. Do you think we're better served as geospatial practitioners as maybe framing what we do as data science?
Well, right. So there's definitely a case of, and you see this tagline by various companies on the newer side of, you know, geospatial data science, right? And the data and, you know, the phrase data engineering, right? And so there's new terms to talk about working with data, that kind of data grunt work. And, you know, to get back to the phrase I'm so fond of like janitorial data work, that now has a new cachet, right? So the idea of, as you said, all the data preparation stuff that is kind of taken for granted in GIS, if you say, hey, I know how to clean, slice, reshape data, right? And now those phrases resonate outside of the geospatial marketplace, because you see the, you know, like Tableau dashboards or Power BI dashboards. They have a whole set of rhetoric around their data preparation capabilities that would be very familiar to the average geospatial practitioner.
I've also heard people, this idea of vector enrichment. Do you think this would be another example of these phrases that exist outside the geospatial world, but they resonate with the people that are, you know, paying the bills?
Well, yes, I came across that phrase with the Amazon AWS. They have a geospatial offering. You know, I think it's somewhat related to SageMaker, but anyway, it's geospatial operations on the AWS cloud, and they charge you per transaction, et cetera, et cetera. And so they have this whole section of like, we offer geospatial enrichment capabilities. And you're like, what's that? So I'm reading it and it's like, oh, that's reverse geocoding and spatial joins, right? And what are the most common things that we do as spatial practitioners are spatial joins. Hey, what polygon is this point in? And so the joke I made on post GIS day is, if the AWS marketing people, who are a lot more skilled at creating revenue than the average geospatial person, if they want to call spatial joins vector enrichment, then I'll gladly adopt that verbiage and reap my minor set of those rewards.
So this reminds me a lot of the conversations I've had with recruiters in the geospatial world. And, you know, I'm sure this is reflected outside the geospatial world as well. What they're looking for when they have a role, they publish it on wherever, and when they get people applying for their role, they're looking for the same words. You know, it's a keyword game. Are they using the same words? And you can confuse them and miss out on a lot of opportunities simply by using other words. And so the game you're playing is, you call it, you know, vector enrichment. You are referring to this data plumbing as data science. You're not talking about a hexagon grid. You're talking about the Uber H3 hexagon grid. Okay, let me use those same words back at you. And you're showing them that, yes, I understand you. I see you. And you use words that resonate with them. And this reminds me a lot of what you're saying now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll even give you a more basic example. One of my best hiring decisions, and I was on the review committee for a city GIS job, right? Kind of entry level, right? And so, you know, you're reading the resumes and they're all over the place and they're talking about their lifeguard job in high school, et cetera. All the stuff you put on your resume, like when you don't have anything else to put on. And this one person had a internship and he used the word concatenate, right? And talking about, you know, how he was manipulating data. And it leapt off the page, because the idea is, if he knew that term as an entry-level person in the specific context of data manipulation, then this is a person we can work with because they already understand that language. And again, if there is nothing else people take away from this episode, is creating very precise, specific language around your individual skills that resonates in different sectors of IT, right? And that is the game, because as you say, the job search game is largely a keyword game. And we are not using or using a very constrained traditional GIS set of words, of vocabulary, it narrows the context of your skills when your skills are actually much more broadly applicable through all different corners of IT and industries than you are giving them credit for. So that language piece is very, very important.
And just so I'm clear, I don't think that you are suggesting that we speak spatial SQL to people. I think what you're suggesting is that use the words that they're using, show them that you understand the problems that they're trying to solve, and remember that you can apply for a broader range of opportunities because you have a very broad range of skills. You don't need to silo yourself into the GIS world.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I even made the point on the very kind of post-GIS day, right? And so to put on your resume post-GIS. So for those who don't know, post-GIS is the spatial extension to Postgres SQL, whatever. And the idea of Postgres has residence in the startup world, in the larger, much bigger context than just GIS. But if you put on your resume post-GIS and expect people, recruiters, managers, to already know that post-GIS is the post-spatial extension to Postgres, no, you can't make those assumptions. And making those assumptions is costing you opportunities in higher income positions. And that's what makes this language conversation not optional in the current marketplace.
Where were you in your career when you figured this out? And maybe you could give us an example of what happened to you after you figured this out. So how did this sort of realization come about to you?
Okay, I have two answers to that. So remember, I was going to get rich through web mapping, right?
Yes, yes.
Every web mapping project is a data management project in disguise. And guess what people don't want to pay for? Data management, especially, it happens under the covers. It's like, what's that guy wasting all my time for? Where's my map, right? So folks who aren't really tuned into the necessity of cleaning up the precious data that they want to see on a map, it's hard to get paid for just grunt data management as a standalone. They want to pay for the map and they have a very specific idea of how much that should cost. So that's one answer. The other answer, and this experience just like burns in my head, Daniel. So I had this like crazy setup where I was taking 3-hour updated hurricane tracks through the Gulf of Mexico and updating my database. And then I had these crazy PHP scripts so people could create buffers in the Gulf of Mexico, and I would tell them how many oil and gas platforms in the Gulf of Mexico, you know, were threatened by this storm track in this dynamic time, like feeding live data, geospatial polygons into Google Earth. How cool is this? So I was sharing an office with a guy. He was successful, Daniel. He was wealthy. He had a PhD in geology. And I tell him, now this is the buffer tool. Look, you can click anywhere and you get a buffer and you can choose how wide the buffer is. And he looked up at me, PhD, successful geologist, what's a buffer? And I'm like, I did not have product market fit. And it was one of those ideas of this is my target user and I am already using language that me and my GIS buddies use every day. And we all know what we're talking about. And yet I'm trying to reach this market that wants to understand, right? Wants to get that depth of understanding. And my use of language is foreign to them. So those are those two early to mid-career, I don't know, tragedies. Is that too strong a word? But they certainly set me down a path of dark nights of the soul. And let's just leave it at that.
Thank you very much for sharing that. Appreciate it. Can I add a podcasting example to this?
Sure.
Okay. So podcasting takes a long time and it's hard to get paid for podcasting. And I remember the only reason this podcast continues to survive is because, you know, I've turned it into a profession. I get paid for this, not for every episode, but for enough. And the way that the big move for me in terms of getting paid for this is understanding what people want to buy and what it is that I am selling. And that sounds like a very sort of difficult thing to hold in your head, but it's, what do people pay money for? And again, back to this language, they use a certain kind of language when they talk about things. So for me, I had to learn the language of marketing, because when people approach me to sponsor the podcast, to sponsor a website, to be featured on the podcast, typically they're a marketer and they're wanting something very specific. And if I don't use their language, we talk past each other. We can't communicate. So I had to learn marketing. And since I learned marketing and figured out, okay, they speak like this, they put emphasis on that, now I understand what it is they're willing to pay for, and therefore I can align what it is that I'm selling to that. So there's a match. And this is what makes this podcast, or lets this podcast continue, is that alignment between what they're wanting to buy, willing to pay money for, and what it is that I am selling. There has been a lot of heartbreak along the way to realizing this. Yeah, and it can be a painful journey and a very uncomfortable journey as well. But it's a journey worth going on.
The downfall of being in a technical field, right, is you want to impress other technical people, right? And so you adopt the language, you adopt, look at this cool feature, et cetera, et cetera. And so we're already dragged into this flattering our contemporaries, our people who already know the insider language, so to speak. And I will just make a broader case. And the broader case is this. This has been a challenge, this marketing challenge, which we're speaking of. This has been a challenge for well-financed startups in the mapping space. You're seeing it now in the larger data visualization and, you know, dashboard world, which seems to be going through its, you know, its own trough of disillusionment of like how to connect the usefulness of sophisticated visualization with actual value that, you know, stakeholders, managers, decision makers can actually use, right? So we have this language that is just not working in that respect in the marketplace, like actionable insights. Well, no one who takes action is looking at your dashboard. I'm sorry, right? So the idea is technical people adopting the right language to reach a broader audience. It's just not GIS people trying to broaden their career prospects. This is a larger problem that's afflicting very, very kind of close corollary sectors of the IT world, such as data visualization.
And I see, you know, within the GIS world or geospatial world, I see two different approaches to this. One approach is, I am going to adapt my messaging, the words I use, the language around this product, service, whatever it is, to the people I'm talking to. And I'm going to use their language back at them. We're going to speak a common language. And there is a different languages out there, depending on who I'm speaking to. So my message changes. The other approach that I see is, we offer solutions. And like, I'm pretty confident that it's the first approach that works better. Those people that adapt to the audience that they're speaking to, they are the ones that will more likely to go on and find product market fit and get paid for their work. If it says on your websites, or if you have problems, I have solutions, I've got news for you. No one is Googling solutions. No one. And if you're selling, I think, for GIS people, sometimes it's, you know, people are looking for a map maker. And I think that's still a valid career path for a lot of people. But if they're not looking for a map maker, telling them that you make maps, well, they're going to think, that's great. They seem like a nice person. When I need a map, I'll come back. And you will miss out on the other opportunities in there.
Well, now you've hurt my feelings, because I'm almost certain there's a version of my, you know, company consulting website, you know, one version, maybe 5-10 years ago, that had solutions somewhere on it, Daniel. I was a solutions provider. And yes, the phone did not ring asking for the solutions provider to please answer. And then it also gets back to the other thing of what we talked about of data, right? Where so much of these issues center on working with the data to get in shape to actually do something useful with it. You can't tell people, hey, your data is dirty and almost useless, right? Until I apply my sophisticated data munging techniques, right? Which will cost you X. I mean, telling people their data is dirty is kind of like telling them their baby is ugly. I mean, it's not the start of a great relationship.
Yeah, I totally agree. What can we do about all this? So we've talked about this, you know, okay, so learn skills that are applicable other places, maybe move out of the, you know, I think the example that you gave was if you're in the Esri world, instead of learning how to get better at the Esri interface, learn spatial SQL as an example. Spatial SQL, you can do the same things, but those skills are more applicable. They give you a broader range of opportunities. This makes sense. Another thing we talked about at length, which I think is very important, is this marketing aspect. You know, use the words back at them. What are they looking for? Can you do that? Don't restrict yourself just to making maps. I realize that is, you know, a tired example, but I am sure the listeners understand what I'm getting at here. So a lot of this appears to be on us. Is that the right way of approaching this? This is our problem. We need to fix this. Or can we wait for a knight on a white horse? And if so, do you see that out there in the world?
Well, let me take that last question last and talk about like what we can do. And the idea is look around and see what issues people are struggling with, right? And people, you know, like you get online, you get on Hacker News, we're arguing about databases, we're arguing about data formats. And then like we go back to our job. What are we doing at our job? We're like fixing addresses. We're fixing numbers that are in text fields and texts that are in number, you know, the very kind of rudimentary stuff that bedevils even the most quote unquote advanced organizations. But the idea of just because geocoding is easy to you doesn't mean it's completely bogging down somebody else out there who's like dying for somebody to turn addresses into coordinates and put it in a spreadsheet, right? And the idea is we're so fixated on the next thing, whether it be, you know, of course, geospatial ML or geospatial AI now, whatever that is, but you got to put it in a context. And I saw a thing on Twitter just a couple of days ago of using these really advanced tools to create polygons of center pivot irrigation from a Landsat image. Now, if you're saying, hey, dude, would knowing how many acres or hectares of center pivot irrigated farmland is in a particular region of the world, is that useful and valuable? Heck yeah. So that's how you need to figure out what are all the different things I do, the little pieces that I do that actually have real value to people who do not think in terms of your geospatial world and its verbiage. So you have to, it's kind of like learning a different language, right? And just not using your internal professional language and broadcasting that out through a megaphone and hoping that somebody responds. And to hit the second part of the question, I do think we're making strides. And I do think there's folks out there who are consciously trying to create a new language around problem solving and dealing with applying these spatial problems to like everyday issues such as, hey, how can I divide a city up into 7 sectors of equal population, right? It's like, let's not call that K-means spatial clustering, right? Let's not use that term. Let's just say, hey, wait, you know, we can create catchment areas or regionalizing an area, blah, 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 right? So there's different ways to make that bridge of language that'll reach a much broader audience than just our traditional constituencies.
I agree. And I totally, wholeheartedly agree with that. I think a lot of us that are in technical roles got into technical roles because we really enjoyed it. And perhaps it was because dealing with technical things, you know, dealing with data was easier than dealing with humans. Like the idea that you can just sit in your room and engross yourself in a technical problem and solve that is a lot easier than all of perhaps all of the moving parts that are around human relationships and dealing with other people. I do think, though, just like we've been saying again and again, that it's a real mistake just to focus on the data and the technology involved. And I think at some stage we all need to learn how to speak human and understand that humans speak a variety of different languages. And if we want to be heard, if we want to be seen, if we want to get paid and have our work recognized, then we need to understand how to communicate that to a human at the end of the day. I realize this has been coming up again and again throughout the conversation, but it's well worth iterating here again towards the end of it. How are you thinking about your skill set going forward? What are you doing to sort of, prepare yourself for the future, knowing that there's a lot of interesting things coming down the pipeline? Are you focusing on, like what we were saying before, these sort of geocoding problems, fixing them? Are you constantly updating yourself and learning different technologies or different skills? Or what are you doing to sort of stay on top of your personal development?
Well, that's a great question. And again, this is going to sound like, every business coach tweet thread that you read on Twitter. Here are the 7 things you need to do right now to become relevant in 2024, right? I mean, after a while, people just like, I can't be this perfect person who, starts the day with an ice bath and then learns the latest JavaScript, framework, right? Yeah. And again, I don't want to go too philosophical, but it's that kind of general life advice of how to continue to draw upon that enthusiasm that brought you into geospatial and how to feed that well into your career, right? And so whether it's acquiring different skills within a segment that has a personal interest to you. So like I know people who are politically active. So using and distributing geospatial information, whether as a volunteer in political campaigns, et cetera, et cetera. But in terms of professional development, right. I mean, there is a kind of requirement just to keep your skills not only up to date, but in a way that resonates with you, right? And in geospatial, like the idea of there's people who love the cartography and actual map making aspect of it. And, you see those skills of, the videos that John Nelson does of how to use all these settings in ArcPro to create these really distinctive maps, right? So if that's your bag, creativity. I'm a data guy, right? So it's like, I love PostGIS, I love Spatial SQL, and I'm creating SVG documents using SQL. And okay, they're NHL shot charts, which are not everyone's bag, but the fact I create a finished map document using just SQL, that jazzes me. And now, stuff we're seeing like DuckDB, which is a database that can, you can completely manipulate within the browser, right? But again, as you're acquiring different skills, you also, that kind of utilitarian part of your brain has to think about, okay, can I position this in the marketplace so it resonates with professional opportunities, right?
I really appreciate that little bow on the end there, because I think it's one thing to acquire skills, but if you're acquiring them with the hope that they are going to make you more money, give you more opportunity, then I think you need to be conscious about the skills that you're acquiring. I think that's really important, and that was the bit that I got out of the end there. So I appreciate that.
Can I just interrupt real quick?
Please.
And make another point is, geospatial is too big to be an expert at everything. So the idea of don't get into bouts of self-laceration because you don't know anything about spatial SQL, but you know a ton about imagery analysis, or you never deal with raster and you like not dealing with raster and you can work with vectors all day, or you prefer to figure out, cartographic presentation and advanced data visualization. The idea is geospatial is too big an umbrella to become an expert at everything. So again, take those bits and pieces that resonate most with the reason you got into the industry to begin with.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. What do you see people asking for out there in the market? What is the skill that you have today that is the most sellable, that is the most marketable?
To be blunt, I save your data projects, right? And like, what does that mean? And again, this is when I started my consultancy. You know, you talked about the difficulty of finding the language of podcasting. Hanging your shingle out as a consultant, you know, you talk about not having no idea of how to market. That was me. You know, I should have just cut to the chase. I offer middle management safety nets for their projects that have, like any IT project, has a high rate of failure, right? I'm the insurance policy. Does that resonate emotionally? Yes, I think it does. Before I even talk about, oh, I use ProtoMap tiles. Does that impress you? No, he or she has no idea what that means. But the idea of data-related projects are failing just like they always have. And now that we're mixing and matching so many disparate data sets together for analysis purposes, all those, you know, creaky abstract concepts we learned in school about data accuracy versus data precision, guess what? The wider world now has to wrestle with exactly the same thing because, right, all the latest and greatest techniques, we're just pouring all these different data sources together into some sort of black box that we label with ML or AI. And then what comes out the other end is supposed to be quote unquote actionable. So the idea of demystifying anything around data and analysis and how to communicate analysis up the decision-making chain, those are the high-value skills that are even more in demand given the technological advances.
So this totally resonates with me. I believe that people will pay to get their problem solved. They'll pay to be seen, to be heard. Although, you know, they'll pay people that speak the right language. Oh, you need a data scientist. I do data science. I can shape and slice your data. I can clean your data. They want to understand that you know what the problem is. And that is not negotiable. I totally believe that. But what I think people underrate is people pay for certainty as well. You use the word safety net. They pay to have somebody that they can point at and say, that's Brian's problem. Brian's on top of that. And they pay for the certainty to know that you're on top of that and you will fix that. And you'll communicate the status of the project in whatever form it's in back to them in a way that they can understand. I have seen this in the real world. People pay for that kind of stuff. And if you can take your hard skills, wrap it up in a language that they understand, packaging that other people can relate to, and then put that bow on it of certainty, security, safety net, I think you're onto a winner there.
I would add to that and say, especially because geospatial is so black box to non-geospatial practitioners, the idea of no one has any idea what is hard and difficult and what is easy, right? And our problem as practitioners is we associate hard, difficult with high value to the end user. When there might be no direct correlation, right? To go back to my geocoding example, right? The idea of how people value their problems versus the sophistication of techniques that are needed to accomplish those problems, complexity, difficulty does not necessarily equal higher value. And if you can lay out the situation to a decision maker, an upper level manager, here are the pros and cons of the approach we're going to take. Here are the risk factors. Here's why it's going to succeed if we can negotiate this, you know, set of known obstacles, right? So all a generalist manager wants to know is there's a route to get from point A to point B. And if something comes up, I need to know right away and have a workaround, you know, in hand, right? A fixable solution. But yeah, if you're a practitioner, right, risk management, risk aversion at the managerial level, and explainability of what's going on. So when you unroll that beautiful map, people know the data behind those colors was analyzed and collected in an intellectually responsible fashion.
Brian, I think this is probably a really good place to wind up the conversation. And I want to say I've talked to you twice now, both times. Fascinating conversation. I really appreciate you for showing up on the podcast and sharing some of your insights with the audience. It's been fantastic. Somebody will be listening to this. Hopefully a lot of people will be listening to this. I think, how can I get a hold of Brian? Where can I go? Is there anywhere online we can point them towards?
I'm still on Twitter with the same amount of reluctance that many are still on Twitter with. But my main area that you can find me is on LinkedIn. And that's the easiest way to get in touch and say hello, and happy to connect with people and communicate. My advice is always free, and occasionally it's worth slightly more than free. So there you go.
Thanks again for your time, Brian. It's been fantastic. Cheers.
Thanks for the conversation, Daniel.
I really hope you enjoyed that episode with Brian Timoney. As always, there'll be a bunch of links in the show notes. Please take the time to check them out. If you want to catch up with Brian, there'll be plenty of places to contact him. Just follow the links. There'll also be a link to Scribble Maps. If you're looking to bring GIS to all levels of your organization, check out Scribble Maps. I think it offers the right combination of functionality and ease of use. And if you book a one-to-one demo and mention Mapscaping, you'll get a discount. And our second sponsor is Mergent Maps. So Mergent Maps is a QGIS field survey app for seamless geodata collaboration and easy synchronization. Notice the easy synchronization. That's important because you can use Mergent Maps to capture geodata in the field on and offline. And sometimes capturing data is the easy bit, but synchronizing it is the tough bit. But Mergent Maps will take care of all of this for you. The app is available for Android and Apple devices, so you can just download Mergent Maps and give it a try. There'll be links to these things in the show notes of this episode. Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. It's much appreciated. I'll be back again soon. I hope that you'll take the time to join me then.